Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. Testing, testing. Testing. Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3.
The Catalyst thing was all right, but it was really very, very rote. Fraser had been instrumental in producing Hoptolite. Hoptolite was a mixed chromium, manganese, cobalt, maybe iron, 4 or 5 oxides used in coal mines for the CO problem. Oxidized CO2. But it seemed like an awfully routine kind of thing. You prepare a lot of stuff, you precipitate all these things, you co-precipitate them, you know, dried them, did a standard catalytic oxidation, then go back and do it again. So I didn't particularly like that. But Patrick's lab, first we prepared silica gel, and then I got interested in a couple of things. One of them was to measure the zeta potential of the silica gel, for which I devised a scheme of trying to set the gel around an electrode, around a silver chloride electrode, which is a nice, interesting trick in itself. And we got along pretty well. I did a lot of work in that. Decided then to prepare the silica as the electrode is such that you could move water through the gel and you could measure the zeta potential by that rate of motion. And I decided to do it in an electrophoresis tube, a U tube, in which you suspended the silica gel and watched the motion. It was an interesting thing. In fact, I pretty much had completed it when Patrick said he had an interesting problem he wondered if I'd work on, which was to try to determine the molecular composition of sulfur-ammonic chloride dissolved in various solvents. You ever worked with sulfur-ammonic chloride?
No, but I read your paper, and it...
Man, that's terrible. That's terrible stuff. If I knew before what I knew just after, I would never have done it. But did it by a Cottrell method. Had 2 Cottrell flasks and just did the differential temperature measurement. One with the salt boiling solvent and one with the solution. And from the boiling point rise and the nominal composition solution, you could determine how much polymerization there was in solution. Patrick had been interested in it because he thought he had a way of refining gasoline using sulfur-ammonic chloride. And this information was interesting, but it turned out you just couldn't handle large quantities of S2Cl2. Even then, I knew enough to wear goggles because that stuff got in your eyes. Some kind of protein coagulation took place that, you know, was sort of the end of your eye. But it was an interesting piece of work because I had to work with a somewhat more elaborate apparatus than I had been up to that time. I had a Julia suspension which permitted me to put a galvanometer inside of an air bath, inside of a water bath, so I could maintain. In other words, it's a very, very precise measurement of a delta T. And because by the time December 1934 rolled around, I was further along on this one than I was on the silica gel problem. I used that for the dissertation. But that really was not my interest. I went back to surface chemistry.
You never published anything on the silica gel?
No. No, I didn't get far enough for publication. See, there's something else about that. So I remember that was about the time that the microelectrophoresis tubes were designed, you know, the kind where you put a single particle under on a microscope stage and follow the movement of that particle under a potential gradient. And that seemed to me to be eminently more suitable than this gross method I use, which is a U-tube and a suspension. And I thought that was farther along, so I just didn't get back to it. I actually got interested. I stayed around Hopkins for a year after 35. In fact, even guys like Joe Mayer had to look for ways to make enough money to stay viable during the Depression. So he took a freshman teaching job at Hopkins. But he didn't know any freshman chemistry. I mean, he was a very bright guy. Quantum mechanics he knew. But he didn't know about precipitating iron sulfide or how you determine chromium or any of that kind of stuff. So he asked me to be his teaching assistant or whatever they call them, the laboratory guy. So I ran his laboratory for a year and stayed around Hopkins for an additional year, kept my lab, and got interested in the fuel cell. No, that's not right. Got interested in the oxygen electrode. And if I knew how I got interested in it, I'd tell you, but I don't. But it annoyed me that it was irreversible. I sort of decided I was going to find out why. And it's now 55 years, 40 years later, and I still don't know why. But anyway, I'd spent a year trying to develop a reversible oxygen electrode and did some interesting stuff. That's where I got interested in electrochemistry. Did some interesting work, and indeed, if you neglect the difference in temperature between room temperature and high temperature fuel cells, 1,000 degrees centigrade, I was doing that kind of work back in 1936 and didn't know it, because that's the kind of anode they use now. I use graphite, very pure graphite rod, and I don't remember the solution anymore, but I was trying to get an oxygen electrode which would approach reversibility if I could raise the temperature, or if I changed the temperature. I didn't know whether to go high or low, so I scanned it. That's what I did during that year, and that was not publishable either, so I didn't. But I did get interested in the oxygen electrode then, and that gave me an interest in the fuel cell later on.
You said at the time jobs were very hard to find. And before we go to that, how was Hopkins faring through this part of the Depression?
Well, they were bankrupt. Not in the current sense, but they couldn't pay their bills in 32 and 33. And I guess people didn't know what you did with the school, but the university couldn't pay its bills. So they probably carried them. And to say the faculty wasn't getting paid either. And some of the very good ones had to leave. See, Hopkins had a first-rate chemistry department. When I came there as an undergraduate, Urey was there. This fellow Ott went on to become the director of research at up in Wilmington, not DuPont. What else is up there?
Hercules.
Hercules, yeah. Emmett was there. Emmett's the guy with Brun Aaron Teller that
Paul Emmett.
Yeah, Paul Emmett.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He was there. He had to leave. He came back, but he had to leave at that time. Huggins, Maurice Huggins was there. He went up, I think, to Rochester, someplace like that. Dave, an outstanding X-ray crystallographer who went to GE. Dave is his first name. I can't remember his last name. Had a whole lot of first-rate people that had to go with it. You know, they just couldn't afford to hold on to them. Guys like Reed State, he was actually retired sometime in that general period. Patrick State, he apparently was independently wealthy, well off, not wealthy, from his silica gel patents. Fraser stayed because he was within a few years. And the small there's a guy named Thornton there. Neil Gordon of the Gordon Conferences was there.
Sure.
But he went off, incidentally, in about 34 or 5, went to Center College. So, the university had a tough, now I don't know about the other departments, I'm sure they had the same kind of problems. The university had a very tough time. And it had to exist on its cash flow. Have any endowment that was functional. But it managed to get along. You know, it's hard to see how it did it, seeing how it works now. If you want to do an experiment, you have to root around the place to find the stuff to do it with. And you didn't go to a catalog. I think somebody was saying yesterday, $200. Well, $200 is hard to come by. We didn't have $200. I can remember making my own relays, mechanical relays. Where you get a wooden spool off that somebody used to sew with, cotton, and you wind some, and you go find an old rheostat and wind some wire, take that wire and wind it on this thing. And get a piece of soft iron. I mean, the whole business.
What about chemical?
Well, it's a little hard for me to remember, but I'm sure that all the chemicals we used came out of a central storeroom and probably used to put spatulas into the bottling and get out what we needed. In my case, the chemicals were fairly simple, except when I was doing this sulfur chemistry for Reed, and he supplied it. I don't know how he got it. But in my own lab, basically distilled water and either salts or some acids or something like that. It wasn't a great problem. At least I don't remember it as a problem. But the equipment I do remember is a problem. I remember spending weeks building thermostats. Finding a box, making sure that the insulation is good in it. Then rooting around the cellar and getting a stir and finding a bracket so I could put the stir on. Made my own thermal regulators. You get some glass and a bulb, then a capillary tube. You go look around for capillary tubing and then put under a microscope and hope that you had a uniform tube, you know. Seal that on top here and then find a thimble or something that you could use as a cap, put a tungsten, weld the tungsten wire into it, and the thermostat, I mean the regulator was obviously the expansion of mercury, and then you calibrated that against a reasonably good thermometer. They did have good thermometers around, I'll say that, precise thermometer. So you'd spend literally 10 days building this thing. And that's the reason it took a year to do something at the time. Now, of course, you buy it. Takes 6 weeks to get it from the supplier.
Given the state of the time, as you said you had applied earlier, you said you had applied to Ohio State and found there were 1,000 others. What about industrial positions? Were you looking at...
Well,
they were probably scarce, too.
They were very scarce. There was a fairly good connection with DuPont. They would send people down from Willing, but I never got an offer from them. I think there were probably one or two other industrial outfits, but I got to tell you, in 1934, there were about 20 to 25 PhDs at Hopkins. And I may have 33 and 34 confused, I'm not sure. But nobody in that group got a job. And I can well remember seeing them in one of the larger laboratories in the building on a PWA project. And the PWA project was to make hoplite, you know, in as many different ways as you could. And each of these guys were, you know how these desks are. There'd be three guys at this desk, three at this one, and there were about 20 of them. And they had these large ungraduated cylinders, about that big, and maybe 3 inches in diameter. And you'd go in there, they'd have a long stirring rod. They'd be stirring, every one of these guys would be stirring the stuff, and there'd be purple and green and blue stuff precipitating, you know, in different form. None of them had jobs. The year I graduated, there were about 20 of us. Hopkins had a good plan. This new plan not only involved people locally that could go, or people locally, but anybody who could be admitted could finish in 6 years. And it came from all over the country. They came from all over the country because somebody, and I think it might have been Gordon, had developed a scheme which involved getting industry to put up money for fellowships, which were geographical. In other words, it'd be one from the Northeast, one from Utah, one from down here, for example. And the class, or the group that got together to get PhDs in 35, the ones I went with, most of them took 4 years, I took three, were from all over the country, literally. And when we finished, most of those guys disappeared. They went back to the regions they came from. The half a dozen or so of us who were local, none of them got jobs except me. I got a job at Loyola teaching the physical chemistry laboratories, and I had this job with Joe Mayer I was telling you about. And between the two of them, I guess I was making $1,300 or $1,400 a year, something like that. Then a guy came to me. Well, I had already started doing a little consulting. That's kind of interesting. It just occurred to me. Somebody came to Patrick and said they'd like him to do a particle size distribution and a characterization on a clay, which they thought was bentonite. And I presume that meant they found a deposit and they wanted to know whether it was worth trying to mine. And Patrick, as I said, was at least well off, if nothing else. And he turned to me and asked me if I wanted to do it. Since I wasn't doing anything, I said yes, which meant learning how to do particle size distribution. We got a settling tube, which was a vertical tube with a at the bottom, almost V-shaped piece that came off was bent and then had a nearly horizontal segment to it. And what you do is put the suspension in the large tube, the bypass tube came off a small distance from the bottom. You put the suspension in the large tube, and it supported a column, which you amplified by this nearly horizontal piece. And as that stuff settled out, its density decreased, its average density decreased, and the meniscus moved back, and you could read the rate at which it moved, and from that you could do a piece of the sailing curve. So I did that, and I guess it took an hour to make the tube and set it up, another hour to do the experiment, and did it a couple times, I was sure. And I came back to see Patrick later that day and said, "Here, I've got the settling curve and distribution curve." He said, "That's fine. Send it to so-and-so and send him a bill along with it." I said, "Oh, good, I'll make $25. And he said, "No, you know, if you do that, they're going to think it's not worth anything because you're not charging them very much. Charge them $200. So I did. And they wrote back, thanked me for the information, sent me the check. I learned a very valuable lesson from them. Don't underrate the value. But because of that, the next time somebody came, he sent them to me again. And this was a man who currently would be called a venture capitalist. That is, he himself was not technically oriented. He had some money. And he went around looking for things that he could invest in. He was a guy who had invested in what was then called no belt. You know, this elastic thing that that they have in slacks, that kind of thing. This guy had already done that, so he made some dough. It was about 1936. And what he had was a device in which he produced suspensions suspensions or emulsions could be produced that were fairly stable. And he was interested in using this on a commercial scale. But he didn't quite know what he was talking about. His name was Mr. Hardy, Harry Hardy. And he came to me, Patrick referred him, he came to me to find out what this stuff might be good for. Well, it occurred to me that there were a number of things. For example, one of the things that at that time on the grocer's shelf, if you were to make a salad dressing, like a French dressing, and you put it on the shelf, in a very short period of time it would separate, and that was undesirable. Even if you try to disguise it with a color, you'd still see it. Also at that time, before your time probably, when you got a bottle of milk, you could see the cream layer on the top. And so I said to him, "Look, if one could homogenize that milk, you'd form a material that would be easier to sell, it seemed to me." And that's okay. Well, that's fine. That's what he wanted to know. So when I came back later, and he had undertaken the deal with whoever this inventor was and asked if I would help develop the use of this machine, and that he would pay me $35 a week and give me some stock. I can't remember how much stock. I had one of my friends there, the only friend that, only one who got his PhD the same time I did, who was already married and he already had a kid. All the rest of us were bachelors. No, that's not true. There was one woman. All the rest of us were unmarried. And I thought this guy deserved some help, so we split the job, he and I. Each got 17 and a half bucks, and each got whatever the stock was. System was a hell of a system. There was an electromagnet which operated a heavy piece 3,600 times. Yeah, it's all 60 cycle. About 3,600 times a minute. It was a hardened piece of steel, which was a kind of an electric hammer, magnetic hammer. And into the hole of that hammer, you put another rod, and that rod would have on its bottom some plates. The plates were made of nickel, usually, or chrome nickel. And you could vary the thickness of the plates. Couldn't vary the diameter, except smaller, but you could make them bigger. And they were fitted on a rod and tightened and so on. And the point was that this was a high-speed churn, for one thing, but also you got vibration, you got the natural frequency vibration in the nickel plates. And finally also, because you could make the clearance pretty close, you got a, what do you call that action? You got this squeeze right at the edge. All three of those things did the same thing. That is, they helped you disperse material. So this other fellow and I took the basic design, built a glass system, and began to make emulsions. Horrendous noise, you know, in a room this size with that hammer going. We learned early to wear ear pieces. Anyway, we made good homogenized milk right away. The problem was, and we did this in 1930, just finished about 1937, we told Hardy that we had the stuff they wanted. The problem was the submarine signal company at about that time was also looking for homogenized milk. And they developed a system in which they acoustically disturbed a plate of nickel and ran the milk down over it, and it was a lot easier than our system. So we lost them. And homogenized milk, you see, began to appear in 1937-38, not before that. So there were two or three processes in the works. Also did this other thing. I told you about the salad dressing. Well, it occurred to me that the way to make that thing, suspend that thing, the oil and vinegar, was to put carbon black in as a Pickering emulsifier. And then we made a very stable oil and vinegar emulsion with this material. And Hardy was all excited, and I was all excited, and took it home to his wife, and she said, "Ick, she wouldn't use a black salad dressing." And it was black, you know, as black as that thing,
sure.
But stable. And I try to point out to her that the carbon black probably do her some good, just the process of some good. So. But we lost that one, too. Anyway, we lost them all, finally. We did, for example, we did bismuth subsalicylate, which was used for treatments of syphilis. And these are needle-like crystals, and they injected into the patient, and they'd have terrible pains where the large particles collected. Well, we broke that stuff up pretty good, and had it developed, and the people at Hopkins Hospital were very interested in it because it certainly diminished the pain problem. But they developed a better way of treating syphilis. So we were behind the curve all the way, and it finally folded in about 1939. And all we got out of the stock was I held it for 10 years and took it off in income tax.